fellow investigators, and welcome back to our video podcast, Into the Darkness, where my friends and I play the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. I'm your host, Tom Rayleigh. Our campaign is Beyond the Mountains of Madness, and we are about to begin episode 11. It was written by Janice Hill and Charles Engen, along with others who are listed in the credits. Our GM for this campaign is Sean Little, and Mick Swan will be giving the recap. The waters have turned icy, the players are ready. Let's begin our journey into the darkness. Nick?
In light of the curious and worrisome incidents which have hitherto plagued us, I thought it expedient to keep a journal for the remainder of our expedition. Try as I might, I cannot shake the ominous premonition that some calamity awaits us. Perhaps I'm growing superstitious in my old age, but this voyage seems bedeviled by misfortune, and it weighs heavily upon my mind. I have, if you will excuse my morbidity, taken the precaution of enclosing a copy of my last will and testament within the flyleaf of this journal, in case the worst should happen. Let us hope it will not be needed. On our second day in Melbourne, we were called into an audience with Mr. Starkweather, who informed us of yet another tribulation, this time in the form of the unexpected death of the ship's radio operator. Our compatriot, Sparky Lynch, agreed to take over the role, which provided some reassurance. Sparky's a good chap, and I have every confidence in him. Starkweather also introduced us to a new arrival, a fellow named Coppard, who fancies himself something of a mystic. Dashed if I know what we need a mystic for, but he seems like a good enough egg. Besides which, he's Starkweather's cousin, so ours is not to reason why and all that. Before we had a chance to begin the day's work, we were intercepted by the police and taken across town to give statements about the saboteur, Henning. It seems I'm not the only one with doubts about Henning. Dr. Lindenbrook also expressed his own suspicions that Henning may have been framed, as the papers describe it. We were each questioned in turn by Detective Murray. From the sound of things, the police haven't much to work on, and young Henning is keeping mum. Having given our statements, we went our separate ways. The other chaps returned to the ship. I went on to Mansfield for a sit-rep, breather, pemmican situation, production of. Job done, back aboard, I discovered we'd been invited to a reception at the town hall. I barely had time to put on the old soup and fish before we were shunted off to Nosebag with Melbourne's brightest and best, and, over bubbly and canapes, presented with the key to the city. Lindenbrook seemed to hit it off with some local boffin, a fellow by the name of McGilvery, who had some kind of curiously marked stone from the West Indies, which he insisted on showing everyone. Quite a queer-looking thing. Looked like a sort of blue soapstone. Eventually, tiring of Melbourne society, we took ourselves off to a local hostelry and a few honest beers before bed. For the next couple of days, we busied ourselves replacing the supplies we lost to sabotage. We were supposed to ship out at 300 hours on the 17th, but owing to a problem with the oxygen canisters, we were delayed a little. Lindenbrook took the opportunity to visit Professor McGilvery again on some obscure matter and returned later with a rubbing of that queer stone he'd shown us all before. And so, eventually, we left port, making the open ocean the following day. As the days passed and we left Australia behind us, the seas grew wilder, and we headed into ever colder climes. At noon on the 25th of October, amidst the fog, we spotted our first iceberg, quite a sight to behold. The day after, as storms and heavy waves tossed the ship about, we heard a great thumping sound from below decks. The alarm was duly sounded, and the ship came to a stop. Along with half a dozen crew, we made our way cautiously into the hold. No easy feat on an icy deck in a hard storm. The air in the hold was thick with kerosene, and we beheld a terrible sight. Two of the aeroplane engines had broken free of their couplings and wreaked havoc below decks. If we were to avert disaster, we had to find some way of securing the engines, and we had to do it bloody sharpish.
Excellent.
All right. You were in the hold. The engines are rolling around. With every toss and turn of the ship, the engines move. You have rope, you have men, You have slippery floors. The men are standing there looking to you guys for some reason, even though they're ship experienced sailors and such. They're looking to you guys like, what should we do first? It's a mess.
Do we have cargo nets? If I remember in Melbourne, when they were loading cargo, they would have like a net and then they would have ropes attached to it. I wonder if we could somehow get a group of men on the top, above on the deck, and drop the nets onto the engines and then have people ready below, you know, on the actual, you know, below decks to grab those ropes and maybe use the nets to slow the engines down and maybe tie them down that way, or at least stop them from rolling from side to side.
The nets are actually underneath cargo, the ones that are on the ship. The cargo is low.
He froze.
Sorry, can you hear me okay now?
Yeah.
Oh, there, froze up. The cargo nets are actually underneath materials in the hold. The edges are pushed up underneath the pallets or whatever you would call them. But there are lots of ropes.
Quick question. These are airplane engines, correct?
Yes.
So how big actually are they? Since they're airplane engines. I get the front end of an airplane, but...
What, 3 foot by 6 foot?
That would be huge for an airplane, wouldn't it?
These are fairly large airplanes. I can actually show you a screenshot, a piece of artwork that comes with the game. It's a fairly large item, and that gives you a general gist of compared to the people.
Well, they got lots of places on there where we can snag a rope. Mm-hmm. If we get on either side of it and throw ropes around it, obviously it's sliding, but it's sliding intermittently as the ship rocks.
And as the ship slows, hopefully the rocking will, you know, as the ship slows, then hopefully they will slow down.
Are there any couplings on the hull that the things are secured to?
Out on the deck, you mean?
No, in the hold.
Oh, the hold. I'm sorry. I thought you said in the there are some grommets built into the wall, some tie-down grommets, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think that we should have ropes ready, and then when the thing slides to this side, we run there, throw ropes around it, run past it, and then when it starts to slide the other way, we've got a hold of the ropes. We can tie them off to something.
Yeah, and then incrementally tighten them on the grommet.
Right. Every time it moves, we can tighten them more.
Right. When you get, it's like fishing. When you get slack in the line, that's when you reel it in.
Right.
Well, if possible, I mean, what we could do is we could secure it on both sides.
Yes.
So that then it's got nowhere to move when it rocks.
Right. I think that it's actually going to be easier than it seems at first, because
you're going to need people with a very high dexterity and you know, former rodeo champs or something.
Well, I think that if you stay calm, mm-hmm. that when it slips to that side, you just walk past it, because it's not going to suddenly jump back. It's not going to move until the ship goes back up and starts to slide again. You just don't panic and move with the ship and don't trip over everything. Watch what you're doing. And I think we should be able to tie it up pretty quickly.
Yeah. Just to get some ropes in on it. That's the only thing we could do is get some ropes and then manpower it down.
Right. So can we try that?
Yeah. And just so you know, there are four of the men are on the floor of the hold with you. Okay. Or I don't know how many of you. How many of you have actually gone down in the hold completely?
Yes.
I'm here.
I'm here.
Nigel?
Well, I wasn't here last week, but I would assume that if it had something to do with the airplane engines, yes. that I would be there.
You'd have been probably the first person there. Yeah.
You're one of the first called down because of the float sound. All right. Everybody has to make a luck roll before we proceed.
John, can you give us a sense? Is the engine like constantly moving, or is there like a spot between peak and?
There is between the peak and trough of the waves. The ship rises and falls, and when it rises, they roll, and then they stop. And when it falls, they roll the opposite direction. But the ship's not going necessarily up and down, you know, forward aft. It's slightly going port to starboard as well. So they're not necessarily rolling in always in the same direction.
I made the roll.
I made mine.
I failed mine by 10.
Okay.
Oh, yes, I made mine.
Okay, Dr. Hawks, could you make a dexterity roll?
Can say get crushed by an airplane engine.
It's just a
I'm gonna say a 63 out of a 55.
All right, just a second.
I have a lovely
one of the fellows near you actually pulls you out of the way. You get dinged, but you don't get squished. You take just one point of damage. It just wings you, hits your leg as you're being pulled free. But
watch it now.
Ooh, thank you.
Don't bleed on my engines.
And the fella falls after he moves you. So there's two guys getting up. One guy is getting down. Two sailors on the ground. One currently down. The other two are getting up. But you're now in the trough area. So everything stopped moving.
Okay.
Okay, so I assume you guys are grabbing rope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's
all right, so who is throwing ropes? Oh, sorry.
I will throw the rope.
Well, just hand me the end of the rope and I'll run past the engine. Then we'll both have ends which we can thread through the grommet on the wall. Don't throw the rope. There's nobody over there to catch it.
No, like lasso it.
We need if it's here moving this way, we need one person on each side holding it so that it won't go back and forth anymore.
Okay.
These things weigh.
Well, I can try to go on the other side. My guy is pretty athletic, even though he's slipped on his butt already.
Wouldn't the safer thing be to tie the ropes to the grommets? And then throw the whole rope with the ends tied to the wall over the engine. Well, and if we do the same on both sides, so that on each side we've got a loop, kind of like it would work like a Venn diagram.
Okay. Yes. Yes. I get what you're saying.
In the middle, then we would when the engine was in the middle. If you've got it on one side, then the ship would shift, and the engine would move to the maximum extent of that rope. And when it reached that side, it would then be in range of the rope on the other side, and we could lash it like that. So it would be, and then we can tighten it up so it's lashed in the middle, so it's not going to roll about.
I will.
Did I describe that very badly?
No, I got it. I will run to the other side. While it's in the trough, and I don't want to be in the way of it when it moves again, but I want to be there so that they can throw the rope to me. I can wrap it through, throw it back with the engine trapped in the center through the grommet. So
the sailors will do anything you ask, by the way. They're just waiting for instructions and diving out of the way as needed.
I have heard that about sailors.
So the idea is to trap it in the middle, tie it off here and here and here and here.
And then once it's in the middle, then we can tighten
we
it
can
up.
We can tighten it up so that it ends up being held in place.
There's two motors, by the way.
There's two of them, right? Yeah.
Well, we'll try to get one.
Because while you're tying down one, you're going to have to dodge the other, unfortunately.
Well, there's a fair few of us. We could work on both at the same time.
That's true. Yeah, there's eight of us. Cats in the cradle. Yeah, exactly. Cats in the cradle. We're making a big, gigantic one with the with the thing stuck in the middle. All right. And we're going to do both of them at the same time because there's 8 of us down here.
All right.
Four of them and 4 of us.
It's unique.
Well, we've got 6 crewmen, so we've got plenty of sailors.
And we might need more than just the 2 ropes. We might need, you know, once we've got the 2 ropes, then we could throw 3, 4, 5 ropes more.
Right.
Then it's easy because they're not sliding anymore.
Can I ask Nigel if tying the ropes are going to damage the
Not engine? Any more than them sliding on the floor is going to do.
Because it's been my experience that a lot of engines have, like, hooks or fasteners where they're meant to be lifted. And
well, I'm sure that even back in the 20s, they would have had some form of lifting mechanism to get them off. They would have big eye bolts in them so that you could pull them out. I mean,
agreed. However, we can't get it through the eye bolts on the first pass. Let's get them to stop moving for a moment before we...
Well, that's what I was kind of asking before.
Then we can secure the eye bolts and stuff.
That's what I was asking before about the timing of it. Is there enough time that we could just go down and thread it through and secure it properly? Or do we have little time where we have to try to lasso it and possibly risk breaking the carburetor off or something like that?
They're rolling, aren't they?
They're rolling.
Well, I thought...
They're rolling like this way, then a bit on an angle. They're not. It's not a straight back and forth.
Right. Are they constantly moving those?
No. It's up when it goes up the wave, it rolls one direction. Into the trough on the other side, it goes in the other direction. And so also a bit
left. So how much time does it remain stationary? How much time? 3 seconds?
10 seconds, maybe.
Yeah, about 10. Yep.
You might be able to do it through the eye bolt.
A long time. If we have those ropes in the grommets on the side, 10 seconds, I mean, you put your watch on it. That's a long time for us to get ropes wrapped around it and pulled tight, to be quite honest. We might be making this a little bit more difficult than it needs to be.
Like I said, if you're just calm about it, you walk over there, put the thing through the loop, hook it up really quick, then you've got to wait a second.
So let's do 8. We've got a total of what? 8 of us, 8 of them, 6 of us, 4 of them.
So at least 2 ropes for each. Yeah, there's 4 of them and 4 of us. Or how many of us are there?
There's
5, 6?
5, 6.
So we've got 10. So
5 on each motor.
Put 5 on each engine. Get as many ropes as we can.
Okay, so let's say, just as a starting idea, that we have 1 on the end of each rope. That's 4, and 1 person in the middle of each group, throwing the rope over and securing it on the engine.
We probably don't have the time to deliberate all these things. This is happening within seconds in front of us.
Yeah, I hate to say, guys, but you have to do another luck roll.
All right.
2 sailors have gone down again.
Where is my luck? Luck.
Made it.
Yeah, I made it.
Made it.
I passed.
No, I failed by 5.
Okay. Could you make a dexterity? Unless you want to use. Well, that was a luck roll. Could you make a dexterity roll?
Sure. Use that luck roll to improve that luck roll.
Yeah, that won't work.
No, Dex has failed.
Can I try and grab him?
Oh. Yes. Way. If you could make a dex roll and see if you can grab him on the way, you can.
I'm trying to remain calm, but with everybody yelling at me, I can't.
Everybody's giving me instructions.
I'm trying to loop it through here. And
pass, not quite an extreme, but
good enough. Good enough. You not necessarily from damage from the engine hitting you, which would have been pretty catastrophic. Mainly from slippage and trying to get out of the way. You take a point. Just from banging against the. No, Elmer. Sorry.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Yes.
Thank you, Captain.
So have we got anything secured yet?
Yes. You can have the grommet, you can have rope secured in the grommets as you wish right now.
All right. Well, let's wait for a lull in the pinball machine here and then start trying to loop them over the engines and pull them tight, and that will press them down against the floor of the floor of the hold, and then they'll stop rolling.
Are you splitting it to 5 and 5 like you said?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Somebody has to make the roll for the attempt. Who's going to do that? Okay. For you guys.
What am I going to roll on?
It should be a grapple, actually. Grapple or dexterity. If you don't have grapple.
I have brawl. Grapple.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. I have it. And I made it.
All right, you're able to rush forward, loop it over, move out of the way with your dexterous pilot skills. You flew out of the way.
All while smoking my Chesterfield.
Well, yep, that's right.
Probably gave the engine a little kiss on the way by because it's
didn't even drop an ash on the floor.
They made one of the crewmen on the other one made the roll as well. There are four left of you, and you have to add strength. So
I've got a pretty high strength.
Yeah.
Just make a strength roll.
Actually, no. It's total strength against the value for the engine.
So what do we roll?
Which four of us?
That's the thing. I need to know which four of you are with the engine that Nigel looped.
Engine A and Engine B. Engine A, Nigel.
I'll be on Engine A.
I'll be on A.
Okay. Well, just for make it simple, make a strength roll for the three, each of you.
And you want the total number?
Yes, please.
37 for me.
Okay.
69.
I made it 53.
Okay, and so you guys actually do get it tied down and through the other grommet on the other side. So one engine is stopped. Now, who is with the other group? That would be Dr. Hawks. Yep. And yep. Who else? Oh, okay, Elmer. So if you guys can make strength rolls, please, and I'll roll for the other two.
Okay.
Oh, passed.
Oh. That's 10.
Perfect.
28.
Okay.
55.
Okay, that's more than the total. So yes, you actually get the loop. The loop is over, of course, already. You get it through the grommet. You get it tied down. It's still moving a bit. It's not perfect, but it's no longer rolling. So.
Well, now we're going to throw at least two or three more ropes.
Exactly. Let's get these things. You know, let's overdo it, so to speak.
All right, so that's not an issue. You don't have to roll anymore. You get the engines tied down. The floor is still slippery, so let's just assume you're being extra careful now. There's nothing rolling around trying to hurt you. It's not, not intentionally.
We need to make sure that their rolling around didn't, fray some of the other ropes in the room that are now getting
or
loose.
Damage the hull.
Yeah, make sure that nothing is.
Well, we need to get something done about clearing up all this kerosene as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
A lot of it is leaked down into the hold below. You can see through the floorboards. So you know it's down there. And also, could someone do a spot hidden, please?
Made it. Critical, in fact.
Oh, no. I got a 96.
Made it.
Perfect. Well, Nigel, since you're the aircraft, the pilot, and you got a critical, you notice when you look at the underside of the pieces of metal that are attached to these hold tie-down ropes for the grommets, you can see that somebody has done something corroding the metal. So the tie-down grommets that the engine boxes were tied down to the hull directly with were previously at some point... and the grommets were corroded themselves with acid.
I point that out to everybody.
You think
does it look like a recent burn?
Does anybody have any kind of engineering?
Well, my idea is that Henny might have done it before he was
arrested. Here's the thing is, mm-hmm. if they use some kind of an acid, then it's going to make the metal oxidize very quickly. So is there any rust whatsoever?
That's kind of the direction I was going.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. Yes. I would assume. Yeah. But let's just assume you look at it. It's not recent. It's not the last, week.
Okay, well, I'm going to let you guys figure out the mystery. I'm going to be taking a look and examining the engines to make sure they're not damaged.
Well, the mystery is it was probably Henning did this, and we just didn't know about it until now.
Well, we were docked. And yeah. maybe we, it really didn't take effect until we were, in turbulent waters.
Yeah, we didn't have rough seas until now.
Right.
Well, check everything. Once again, we got to check everything.
And we probably want to take stock on current aviation fuel, because I'm sure whatever we've lost is going to cut into our trip time once we make land and we need to do flyovers.
Did we lose aviation fluid? Do we lose aviation fuel?
You didn't lose the aviation fuel as much as you've lost the kerosene.
Okay, so like for lamps, fires, mm-hmm. cooking.
About 50% of the kerosene is gone.
Damn.
Still a major fire hazard. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So the crew should get started cleaning that up right now.
Is there any way to recover some of that kerosene?
Possible, I guess. It's if you know that you haven't been down to the hole below, like the below hold, so uh-huh. someone would have to go down there and examine that.
Right. Do our supplies include any rolls of Bounty?
Or Brawny. Do we have any Brawny?
Or Downy.
Or Seabirds.
So I'm looking at the cross section of the Gabrielle, and so I'm looking at the lower hold. I see where the airplane is. I guess I want to know, when you say that the kerosene is leaked below, has it leaked down to where the drums of aviation fuel is, and it's gone down to the very bottom?
Yes.
Okay. Wonderful.
It's going to be a slippery, sticky mess down there. You know that. The examinations, it doesn't take a role necessarily because you have enough air crew and other people are showing up now. You do see that the engines are no good. They're gone. And the aircraft itself, the Boeing, is now also damaged beyond repair. The wings are crushed. And the body of the aircraft is also damaged. So you're down to 3 aircraft from 4.
Now I know why sailors cuss.
At this point, it wouldn't hurt if we went through and meticulously checked everything we could think of to look for any more signs of sabotage.
Yeah, any more goodbye gifts from our saboteur.
This guy must have a cloak of invisibility because he got everywhere on this ship without no one noticing him at all.
He was a member of the crew.
Still.
That's the perfect disguise, right?
He was a low-ranking member of the crew, so... Right. Everybody, well, also, if they saw him, would just assume that he was told by somebody to go get
He's following orders, literally and figuratively.
Well, someone want to make an idea roll?
Not me.
Not
17.
Me.
Yes.
Oh, I failed.
Okay. Well, Mick, Captain Sugden, you know full well that even though you're not a sailor, you know the way that on a ship, the main hold is shut. Generally, people don't go down into the holds except for crew. But the man hold, the man door, the man-sized hold door was not locked. So during the voyage, anybody could have just, when they weren't being watched, go down inside.
Well, we know he's already he's gone into the hold before to sabotage the radios.
That's right.
Somebody needs to take a report upstairs to to Starkweather and Moore about this.
I assume they were here.
No, they're in their cabin.
I'll go talk to Starkweather and Moore.
We only heard this because we were having class right in the area nearby, and we heard the banging around.
I thought there was an alarm sounded.
There was.
And they didn't respond to it.
Well, it's the middle. Alarms are set. They wait for reports back. That's why two crew members didn't go down. They were running back to the the helm to tell people what was happening.
All right.
So, Mr. Starkweather, when you do actually finally one of you leave.
You stalled, Sean.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Mr. Starkweather is actually above decks now in a sheltered doorway, watching intently, talking to others around him, wondering what's going on.
I'll explain to him what happened. We lost a plane. We lost two engines. We lost a lot of kerosene. We have a fire hazard, a mess.
He says, thank you. Those are the details you give him?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do tell him that that from the looks of it, the saboteur was quite some time ago and just now took effect.
That's what he was waiting to hear. Didn't want to hear it. Storms off, says thank you. Slams the door. You can hear him even through the metal door. Swearing, or he's slamming his fist, punching things, throwing things, furious.
Yeah.
He's not a happy camper. You can hear him yelling, no, out of the question, impossible. No, no. You don't know who he's talking to, actually. He says, three planes or two or one, it doesn't matter, we're going on, I tell you, get out. And the door opens and one of the officers, you're not necessarily, you can't see who it is, just comes out. Takes off into the darkness.
Well, we're down a plane and two engines.
Look, there's a pattern here. Acid seems to be the preferential choice of sabotage. It was used on the radios, the refrigeration, excuse me, now the airplane. We need to look for other things on this ship that might be sabotaged with acid. That, as the most likely things, in this case, structures that were weakened. If there's any others like it, any others in the hold, we need to check.
Well, I want to check out the rest of the planes and make sure they're secure.
Okay. Yeah, because we don't want to be airborne and have the wings snap off and. Because they were eaten away with acid.
Or the cup holders falling off. And
that would be disastrous. Your cups would just fall right
through. I also think
it's
time that we need to get the crew on our side. And I think we need to start increasing our vigilance. Because we really don't know where to look, where to inspect. So I think it's, you know, there's six of us, but there's, you know, dozens more that we can enlist in our effort to kind of, you know, keep an eye out for future trouble, if that makes sense. Because our assumption here is that the saboteur is off the boat and there are no assistants left on board, right? So it behooves everyone to kind of increase their vigilance and start checking and looking over their area for any acid burns or any signs of damage.
Yeah. Well, we can talk to the bursar about that. And bursar? Bosun.
I definitely want to check the mountaineering gear. As you say, I mean, the last thing you want is to find.
But we're the ones who at the moment have nothing to do. So the crew all have stuff they have to do.
I think we should talk about a lockdown. Knowing going to any location they're not supposed to be.
Well, they have to run the ship the way they run the ship, so. I'm sure that that's, in general, the rule anyway. Anyway.
Okay. Well, it's been a couple of hours. Everything's tied down. You've identified the engines are toast. The ship, the aircraft itself is no good. And the kerosene has leaked down into the lower portion of the ship. Mr. Starkweather has gone off to his cabin and it's evening. Nigel, you want to look at the other aircraft, you can do that, and you'll find that there's nothing else that you can see wrong with any of the aircraft.
You now have some spare parts, so a lot of them.
Different aircraft.
Yeah.
It's like Lego, you just put different wings on different airplanes to make a biplane.
Well, some of the parts might be interchangeable.
Yeah, that's true. So yeah, it's like 8 o'clock, 8:30 in the evening, and the storm continues. So I would assume that are you going to actually approach anybody with this idea of searching the ship more, or are you going to do it yourself?
I actually want to go talk to Sparky. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, I think I was told by someone that Sparky, or maybe Sparky himself, that he was monitoring communications on the ship that is ahead of us. So I would just like to talk to him for a moment and see if he's picked up any communications. Is there any sign of sabotage on that other ship, the other expedition? Or are we the only ones that are having these difficulties?
No, he's easy enough to find. He's always in the radio room. He sleeps there. Mm-hmm. It's not mealtime. He's happy to see you. He said, you ask him those questions. Says you had that he's had intermittent, sounds from the ship. No, not like he could. It sounded like the voice of the Tallahassee radio operator, mm-hmm. but he hasn't been able to determine where they are. But certainly, there's no frantic reports back to the mainland or anything like that.
Okay.
I go talk to the bosun and explain to Mr. Blunt that. That even though our saboteur has been captured, he may have sabotaged more things on board the ship than we're at present aware of, that he should just have his men keep their eye open, especially for any kind of acid damage, which seems to be the guy's modus operandi.
Well, he's understanding, accepts your outlook on things. Says that problems with a storm right now, and most of the half the crew are sleeping. But he'll increase the watches after talking to the captain briefly, and suggests that over the next couple of days, if the weather allowing, if there's some free time, some men could be spared, he'll certainly put some people at your disposal to help go from hold to hold, area to area, to make things tied down.
Right. He can do. I suggest to him maybe an inspection. Maybe mm-hmm. make sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to do, more or less, make sure all their equipment is in good working order and hasn't been sabotaged. But, okay, thank you.
That weather tomorrow, he says, is it looks like it's the wind's going to drop. So there should actually be some a lull in the storm tomorrow to actually do some of this. Okay.
Excellent.
All right. Nothing more of note that evening, I would assume, unless there's something else anyone wants to do. Okay. Next day, you wake up, breakfast, Mr. Starkweather's nowhere to be seen, Mr. Moore's nowhere to be seen. The winds have dropped off. It's visibility's poor with lots of heavy snow, but there's not as much wind this time. Many icebergs. You can see them in the distance just by going on the deck. You can see them. It does have a lot of snow on it, so it's quite slippery. There's lots of ropes that have been attached to various grommets along to act as additional handholds because of the storm the night before. You start your search. Is that your plan?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Might as well go from stem to stern.
I have a kind of a question. If you're on a ship like this and it's snowing heavily, do you have to have people on the deck constantly brushing the snow off?
The heat should melt the snow.
But it's a metal ship. Why would there be any heat at all?
The engines are very hot. The boilers are very hot.
The deck, the metal deck would be cold, wouldn't it?
The deck's usually made out of wood, though.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that show on whatever.
Deadly's Catch.
Yeah, they've got ice covers everything because the constant.
Well, that's the ice. That's a different situation. That's when you have mist in the air. Yeah. It's not snow necessarily, or snow that melts on the warm ship, and then it freezes. So yes, there's a lot of ice chipping that occurs in storms. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's not a sailing ship, so it's not so much of an issue for that. But it is the ice adds weight to the ship, so they have to constantly make sure there's no ice building up because it's just the water's
heavy. Capsize, yeah. All right.
I was Reserve Coast Guard for a couple of years.
And it's Sunday the 27th?
It is now, actually. It's 27th, I'm sorry. Yes, you're right.
Okay.
The storm has dropped off slightly. Your work for the 27th, you don't find anything in particular of note.
Okay.
Day ends, 28th. Again, the weather gets even better. Still snow, plenty of icebergs still. Do you wish to continue? You've still got probably another day or two's worth of if you're going to go from stem to stern.
It's like we've inspected these things so many times. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous, but yes.
A successful idea roll brings up the idea of manifest checking. No, it's just there's no manifest to check. 28th, again, same situation, nothing of note. 29th. The sailing continues south, and they're starting to have to dodge some rather large icebergs. Thick and snowy weather, poor visibility. This is the usual weather forecast goes up on the wall outside the mess. And the Gabrielle turns west in search of clearer water. So Mr. Starkweather's seen again, and he asks for an update on your searches. Seen anything, found anything, he asks?
Not anything of any importance.
Good. Do you think we can assume that this was Mr. Henning that did this?
Hard to probably. Say.
Well, he says, I've been getting reports from the captain that the crew kind of are taking this in stride. So at least we don't have a situation like before where they're watching our every move. All right, well, continue if you wish. That would be a good thing if you could at least do one full sweep of the ship and finish that up today. That would be great. We can put this behind us and move forward.
All right.
Okay. All right, well, easy enough. You finish the sweep by the end of the day. It's not that difficult, and you find nothing. Nothing new, nothing of note. And so now it is the 30th. Thick ice all around you. People are on deck watching every direction at all times. People who aren't necessarily doing any physical work. Everybody's on order, strict order to watch and make known any situations that look hazardous. Essentially, everybody's on iceberg watch. They're pushing through ice. The ship is actually starting to push large blocks of ice, push smaller icebergs out of the way. Ice flows are everywhere, flat sheets about half a mile long, like something most of you have never seen before other than black and white photographs. You know you've reached the outskirts of pack ice now. You are in the Antarctic. And the pack is, as Mr. Starkweather suggested, loose and running. So spring is upon you.
Now, is our ship designed to be at least in part an icebreaker?
It has a reinforced hull, yes. Not as an icebreaker, but enough. More so than previous exploration ships from days gone by.
So we're slowly pushing our way through.
Slowly pushing your way, but not necessarily going south yet. You're still going west, like along the edge of the pack ice, sort of on an angle, kind of trying to loop your way in. The next day, the 1st, westward progress is stopped by the ice, so the ice has moved out.
How about Halloween, the 31st?
Well, the Halloween was, this is Halloween, not the 1st, rather. I forgot how many days we were in October. It is now Halloween. To the south and points and humps of the pack extend as far as you can see. And the sea is flat. The sky is cloudy. Air is clear but cold. No snow. And even the usual swell of the sea is like, it's almost as if the ice is dampening that. Well, that's probably what is happening. The unmoving deck feels strange because it's the first day that you've had absolutely no rolling or pitching. And you hear cracks just from some of the ice breaking up as it reaches the slightly warmer water. And there's a thin crust of ice on the sea that you're pushing your way through. You're constantly hearing crick, 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 crick as the ship pushes through it. Okay. There, on the skirts the edge of the pack for a couple days more without finding a way south. This is getting very frustrating for the ship's crew. They're looking for a way to head south. They're just having to go around the edge of the pack ice trying to find a break. And at 3 o'clock in the morning on November 3rd, a lookout spots a broad open lead of clear water right to the southeast through thicker flows. Starkweather says, gun it, get through that. And the captain presses on fast. By noon, the ship has pushed 20 miles into the pack ice. Walls and cornices of ice rise, you know, all over. You're surrounded by ice. It's completely completely bizarre to see such large walls of ice on either side of the ship. It's actually quite disconcerting for you. The ice rises and falls on either side, rubbing and crumbling in blocks, man-sized blocks just falling into the water beside you. Nobody wants to rest. Nobody wants to go below decks and just read a book. You're actually quite disconcerted by all of this. And constant gunshot cracks and bangs, and the barometer begins to lower again towards sunset, but the ship pushes on. That night, another storm hits, just as powerful as before. Winds up to 70 miles an hour. This time, the pack ice is starting to shift, and around the ship, the ice moans and creaks, and huge bergs roll and grind against the Gabriel. Nobody can sleep. You're not sleeping during this. Again and again, the ship clangs and heels as spines and shoulders of hard ice press against the hull. Armor plates groan, yield, but the ship survives, and there's nothing you can do. But you come out on deck the next morning, and there's ice everywhere. Great seams and gouges, pushed over the rail. But the storm's over. But you're locked in for a bit. Ship pushes forward, and all hands are on deck. And they say, everybody get a pole. And they bring on poles from the hold. And even you guys are asked to have poles to actually try to push with all your might to shove the smaller bergs apart. As well, people are being asked to help repair damage. Does anybody have any mechanical skills?
I do.
Okay. A little.
Okay. No, not at all. 10%.
Anybody that does is ordered, not even asked, you're ordered to help repair minor things that are broken down, and everyone does their part as they can. It's actually quite disconcerting that now that the wind has stopped, that it's just right in your face everywhere you go. Every shade of blue shifting from white blue to just sort of brilliant dark blue. And through the 4th and 5th, it just continues on. But on the morning of the 5th, Sparky comes running out, and he looks at you guys, and he says, hey, guys, guess what I just heard? The Tallahassee's trapped deep in ice. 300 miles to the east. He says, I got to go tell Starkweather.
Well, that'll make him happy.
So does that mean that the first time we might be outpacing the Tallywhacker or whatever?
Tallahassee.
Tallahassee.
Something completely different.
I'm not entirely sure what the first of those words actually means, but I have a feeling it might
be. But I like
it.
Tallywhacker's my new favorite word. Starkweather comes out and he's smiling. Smiling ages. And he walks out on the deck and he says, oh, everybody put your backs to it. Let's get moving. So everybody helps out.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what your job is.
Yeah.
Okay. November 6th. Everybody eats, goes to bed the night before. You wake up in the morning, wind's dead. There's a thin mist. Creepy, thin mist blowing around. Ghostly vapor's fingers rise up from the water that's warmer than the ice surrounding it. They curl around the ice. Anybody that had even a slight belief in ghosts would look at these and say, that's questionable. The colors of the sea and ice blend and twist eerily off into the pack. Distant objects blur and reappear. There's mirages. Illusion-like things seem to float in the sky and then disappear again as the light changes, the angle of the light changes. 1 minute, the lookouts can see the horizon. Next, they can't. Sometimes bergs seem bigger than they are. Sometimes they're smaller than they are. But 9 o'clock that morning, a cry is heard from the lookout as a darkened mass on the far side of an iceberg comes into view. Gabrielle gets a little closer because they change course just slightly. And the bow of a trapped whaler can be seen protruding from the ice, half frozen in a drift. Like this.
Wow.
First Officer Turlough surveys the wreck through binoculars, and you guys are nearby because you are. And he says, it's the Wallaroo. She disappeared last autumn during a squall. No one's found a trace of her till now. Starkweather Moore come out. Captain, they're all talking about it. Gabrielle pushes closer. And he says, well, a little bit of an interesting adventure for us. Who wants to go and take a look at this?
How did the ship get lifted out of the water like that? That's amazing.
Ice. The ice can do some pretty wild stuff. I'll go on the ship.
Is this a ship from a previous expedition? Would we have heard of this?
It's a whaler.
It's a whaler that just went missing.
Oh, it just got lost, or
whaling.
A year previous.
I'm not interested in risking anything, so I'll stay.
I'll let you young kids go have some adventures.
I'm up for an adventure.
There's Nigel.
No paparazzi Palmer. There, Elmer.
Oh, for sure.
Nigel. Dr. Hawks?
Yeah, I'll go as well.
You're not wearing a red shirt, though.
No. Not yet.
Captain Sugden, are you going to go or stay?
I'll go and have a shifty.
All right, so there's four of you. All right, three more sailors go with you as well, along with a small rowboat pilot. It's not a rowboat.
I'm seeing that they have the red shirt.
Is it a skiff, by any chance?
It is a motored skiff, motor-powered skiff.
It's a dinghy.
No, dinghy only seats, what, four? I had a dinghy once. They lower the ship. Hey.
That's not a euphemism, people.
Actually, I have one. All right. God.
We've gone this far without it. That's what she said, so let's just keep it at that.
God. So they make their way. The ship's lowered. You get in the ship. The water is crystal clear, crystal smooth, or light, smooth as glass. You make your way to the ship. As you get closer, I'm not going to hide from the rest of you. As you approach, you can see the ship has been split in half at the midpoint. Ice is fully encompassing the fore of the ship, the front end of the ship. So it's kind of eerie to see, like, you can see through the blue of the ice into the ice, and you can see the shape of the rest of the ship in there. But there's it's broken. Like, there's a crack between the two halves. The aft is twisted metal explosion scars in the metal. You can see something obviously happened, and anybody who's been on through the ship, as the wind blows across the ice, it makes strange whistling, creaking, sharp noises. And one of the sailors picks up a rope, makes a throw. Ah, ka-ching. He tethers the longboat to the wreckage and is able to pull alongside. So Everybody has to make a climb roll or a dexterity roll.
I'm going to go for climb.
Okay. Ooh.
Seven.
Made it. 20
out of a 60.
Did you just break your streak there, something? Climbing and water, that's not a good combination for you.
I know. I've finally got a character that can do it.
And with that said, I rolled a 90.
You did?
I did.
Well, could you do a luck roll then?
My luck is pretty good. Yeah, luck pass.
All right, just a second. I am sorry to say, you take 2 points. You twist your ankle. Not so much that you can't walk, but it's not going to be happy for you.
Okay. It's the same one that hurt me, engine man.
Yeah, likely.
You don't want to fall in the water up here, down here.
That's what it is. Yeah.
So everybody has made it onto the ship. The small boat is tied off at the other end as well, so it doesn't go anywhere. And you're near the midsection. The ship is where you climb aboard. So you're on the deck. It's pieces missing. It's in fairly rough shape. It's on a bit of an angle, so it's slippery, but not so slippery that you have to make a roll dexterity very frequently. No, not at all.
You said
actually an entrance down below. Sorry, go ahead.
I think you froze there. But I was going to say, did you say there was explosions? Signs of explosions?
Yeah, there's signs in the midsection of an explosion, likely the boiler room.
Oh, okay. Due to
it's like the metal has blown outwards. You can assume that something went off inside the ship.
Okay. Should we try to go below deck and try to get some food or something like that to bring back for the... of the families or anything like that, so maybe get some documents or
yeah, the log would be a good
log.
Is it possible someone could still be alive?
It's been a full year.
Oh, a year. I thought you said August.
Autumn. Previous autumn. Sorry.
Autumn. Okay. Sorry.
I get in trouble for saying autumn all the time. Fall of last year.
What?
All right, so you're aboard the ship, and there's definitely entrance at the front. There's a cargo hatch, 1-2, and another entranceway to the bow of the ship where there's another doorway actually to get into the ship, so you can choose which way you wish to go in.
Grab a hatch.
Can't help but wonder whether we might find some kerosene on board.
Ooh, yeah. Watch out for the bow people.
Yeah. Inside, so I would assume everyone brought some kind of flashlight. The crew certainly did. As you go down below decks, there's a cargo hold. There's a smaller cargo hold. And there's you can see the hallway going on both sides of what you assume to be cabins down the middle. Similar to your ship's layout.
We're gonna probably end up running into bodies here, but let's just start opening one door after the other. There could be survivors. It would be rare, but it's possible.
I think I'm gonna have a look at the hold. I think, as far as I'm concerned, the contents of the hold is salvage. Poking around in some dead fellas, bits and pieces is I'm not interested in that.
One of the crewmen lights up a fairly substantial lantern rather than little flashlights, and you look below and you see that what you thought was bits and pieces of wood that you were stepping on was not in fact wood. It's the remains, bits and pieces of people. Arms, legs, hands, heads. This flesh has been stripped away over time. bodily fluids have frozen in pools. The bones are sticking up, right? So everybody has a pity roll.
Ah, shit. I failed it.
33. Oh,
59 out of 60. I've made it by 1 point. Oh, I'm quivering now. I don't like it.
You failed, Nigel?
Yeah, I failed.
Okay.
Shaking, you silly goose? No, it's just cold, that's all.
Nigel, you're... The sight of the remains, the one thing you notice that everyone else doesn't notice, is, which is what puts you over the edge a little bit, is that none of these body parts have clothing on them. Like there's an arm and a part of a shoulder. There's no sleeve attached to this.
Okay. Well, first of all, how much sanity do I lose?
Four.
Okay. I'm still good there. All right. So here's my question to
everyone else loses one, by the way. Sorry.
Okay. Here's my question to you is looking at the body parts, does it look like they've been dismembered by an axe, claws? I mean, they obviously just didn't fall down dead and froze to death. Something dismembered them. So there's got to be signs of either like some kind of a bladed weapon or bear claws or something along those.
Okay, can I take a look at the body now?
Yeah.
Can I do like a medicine check?
Damn doctor, man.
Yeah. I know I'm picking up the arms and chasing Nigel with him.
I will shoot you.
So when he turns his back, I'm going to tap him on the shoulder with a
screaming erupts from the ship.
I'm going to do a medicine check, so a 37 out of 61, just to look at the body parts to see if I can tell if they were ripped apart, cut, or...
There's not a lot of flesh or anything left on them, but you sort of look around at the pattern of body part, the pattern of where things are lying, and it seems to you like there was probably an explosion, and people were very close to it when it went off.
Okay.
So, and there are some mild scorch marks within the ship, but not a lot, but differently, some mild scorch. It may have been a steam boiler that exploded or something like that.
Let's get the log and get out of here.
So you're moving aft then. You come across no sanity roll required.
Oh, froze.
Lost you again.
Did I lock up?
You. Yeah.
Yeah, you locked up at no sanity roll required.
Oh, sorry. No sanity roll required. However, you come across nice, neat rows of skeletons lying on top of one another like cordwood.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Then you can see there's doors. Some of them are open and closed. These are what you assume to be crew quarters. Small, cramped, 8 foot. There's no bodies in any of them. Shredded, moldy linen clothing. There's some personal effects here and there. Several nets containing discolored clothing been sitting there for a while.
Yeah, nothing's going to be salvageable in all this.
No. There's another a larger door, and it's not open, but as you approach it, it says captain on the door.
Oh, open it.
Mm-hmm. Larger room.
Search.
Not quite twice as big. The remains of a feather bed, trunk. Trunk has iron bands on it, closed with a padlock.
Well, I could shoot the padlock off.
You know, in a big metal ship, that'd be fun.
Well,
one of the crewmen says,
This is Call of Cthulhu. No one ever has lockpick skills.
the crewman comes forward. He's got a fire axe with him. He found it down the hallway. He takes a whack at the lock. Well, just give him a chance to get through it. He whacks the lock and ka-chunk, doesn't do anything. 97. He puts the axe into the floor and has to pull it out of the moldy wood. Anybody else want to take a try?
Yeah, I got a good swing.
Ah, sure. Go ahead.
I guess that would be off a brawl.
Yeah. Strength or brawl.
Either way, I made it.
Excellent. Lock pops off. Door open, or you can open the lid. Drawers are lined with inside you find interesting. There's a logbook.
Well, take the logbook.
Several photos from the captain's family. Fountain pen. Could you do a spot hidden?
Oh, critical.
Oh, you put your hand and go, look at this. Ping. Pops right open. There's a false back on the inside, and you find an iron key, a leather pouch, several gold coins of unknown origin, but they have oddly shaped sea creatures on them.
Well, I take it.
Okay.
Now, what would the iron key be for? Is there anything in here that looks like the key would fit?
Doesn't appear to be.
Well, I got the logbook. That's the important thing.
A deck of many.
He froze, but I know what he was saying.
A deck of many things, yes.
Bag of holding?
Bag of holding, yeah. Plus one dagger. Do you want to look at the logbook, or are you just going to...
Yeah, we're going to look at the logbook. Give it a little... I mean, we don't have time to study it, but give it, okay. You know, a little peeky-poo.
Elmer, while he's doing that, you sort of glance to the right, and you notice all of a sudden that the bed, what you thought was just a pile of blankets and feathers, is actually the captain's body. So
Captain had feathers.
He's right there. It makes you jump. Captain Feather Sword.
Gee,
what happened to him?
Would the temperatures here at this point be cold all year round?
Well, for the past year, there's been a spring, a summer, like the same seasons we have, but not necessarily as warm as we have, and temperatures would approach freezing or above freezing slightly the farther away you get from the actual coast of Antarctica.
Okay. I was just curious. I was wondering what the level of decomposition would be, because if we're frozen, if we're constantly like below freezing.
They basically mummify.
Yeah. You don't know how far south it went before it got frozen into the block of ice and moved this way.
Would I know, or even the other gentleman here, would we know, is it possible this ship is just blown completely off course, or would this be considered whaling waters?
I don't know if you'd know, but there's sailors there, you could ask.
Okay. The sailors that are with us.
I might say the logbook as well.
Yeah. I mean, if you're asking, just wonder if this blew off. They don't know of the ship itself, but they say that the whalers go as far south as they can.
Okay.
They go as close to the coast as they can. So it's entirely possible it went farther south.
Okay.
The logbook generally details what happened. I mean, you haven't studied it in detail, but let's just say you, by chance, flip to the end. And it says, my hand is wholly useless now, lost the gangrene, and the red lines of infection have spread past the tourniquet up my arm. There's nothing to be done. My own stench disgusts me. Bowers passed on the night. I'm no Shackleton, no Mawson. To face the odds and overcome them, I am merely an old, tired soul who has lost the gamble and will die upon the ice alone. The horrible, endless ice is beautiful but heartless. In these past few days, I've come to hate its cruelty, its cries and whispers and moans to me in the still air, grinding hopes and prayers away in mindless, hostile fury. I pray the others got away. There's nothing for anyone here. Even the whales are long gone. Should anyone ever find this log, let me praise once again the excellence and skill of my officers and crew. Their loyalty and stout hearts are without peer. I wish them well and pray that they now safely homeward bound, that they are now safely homeward bound. I give my love to Nancy and the boys. May they find happiness in years to come. I only regret that I cannot hold them to me one last time. Forgive me what I'm about to do. And that's the last entry in the logbook.
Well, we're taking the logbook with us, obviously. I'm sure that somebody in the port would see to it that it got back to the families. Yep. Say a little prayer. There's nothing else we could do. They're long dead.
So there's three cargo holds as well you haven't seen as well, if you wish.
Yeah, so what's in the cargo holds?
What was in that leather pouch, too?
Coins.
Oh, that was the coins. Okay.
Yep.
Also, can I just mention, it seems odd that he would write something like that in the logbook and then lock it away in a trunk.
Well, he's wanting to keep it safe because he obviously killed himself.
Is there a gun in the bed?
You don't see one.
Well, he said he forgive me for what I'm about to do, which implies that he yoffed himself. Could have been poison, could have been whatever. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, no, I understand. I'm just saying it seems odd to me. If you're going to leave a suicide note, you leave it for someone to find. You don't lock it away in a trunk.
Well, once again.
Is there a key in the bed?
You can search.
Yeah, I'm going to search. Yeah. Well, it's just roll bones. It's just bones.
Well, you don't have to roll, but you're pretty disgusted by it. Yes,
yeah, I'm not happy about it.
He's pretty dried. He's mummified. You sort of flip him over, look around. There's no other key.
No other key. Okay.
So we're done here unless you want to use him for cordwood.
Huh.
What's in the holds?
The first cargo hold, that's just where the slaughtered whales were kept. It's a larger one. It's a whale hold. One of the sailors tells you that. Kind of a foul smell. It smells like dead flesh. But it's half filled with the remains of whales. Meat, barrels of lard, fat, and blubber. Bits of stuff with commercial value stacked around the outside. Everything's frozen solid. The hatch is kept out much of the ice from the outside. There's a dusting of crystal sparkles that has fallen down between around the crack of the hatch. Nothing really of note otherwise. Second cargo hold. If there were supplies in here, they've all gone. They've rotted, spoiled. There's a half dozen cases of canned goods. Labels have fallen off. Things lying around the ground looks like leaves. You go closely to the labels that have fallen off all of the cans. And the third cargo bay, similar cargo bay two, boxes, barrels, supplies, nothing really exciting. The only salvageable thing is there seems to be a locked strong box bolted to the forward bulkhead.
Aha! Key. Does my key work?
It does.
Aha!
Yeah, 12 bottles. 12 bottles of rye whiskey.
Well. I think we will be collecting that.
The sailors all snicker at that find.
Well, I imagine that comes under legitimate salvage, doesn't it?
Sure, we'll have to have a toast to them later on.
Do we know the name of the ship?
The Wallaroo.
The Wallaroo. We'll have a toast to the Wallaroo.
also weird, too, that he talks about the other sailors going home, and yet we found a ship full of skeletons.
Well, going home could mean dying. But it, from what the log said, the way it sounds, some of them tried to escape, tried to get off the pack ice and find, so, you know, rescue. That's the what I was implied from it. I could be wrong.
Okay. I don't know what else to do.
You've essentially viewed everything that you can find.
Let's get out of here.
Okay.
All right. Out you go. Back on the small boat. No dex roll required. And you're heading back to the ship, and you spot something in the distance, way off towards the west. About, I'd say it's about a mile and a half.
Let me guess.
Too far for you to row.
Tallahassee.
Or not row. Get the binoculars out, and you can see it's something sticking out of another block of ice down the way.
We can't see what it is.
Mile and a half away.
Well, that's up to the captain if he wants to investigate further. Could be a body from one of the people who tried to escape off the ice. Could be another ship as far as that goes. I mean, I imagine I've never been to the Antarctic, but I would imagine that lots of ships get lost down there. But my guess is it's probably a body that from one of these guys. I mean, am I reading that right? Did it make it sound like some of the group tried to get out on foot? That's just the impression that I got.
GM doesn't have to answer that question.
He doesn't have to. I mean, just
your impression is the impression that your character got.
You wonder. Well, you get back to the ship. You board the ship. Captain Stark, the captain, rather, asks you what you saw. The sailors report as well as you, and one of the sailors on the deck, who has a better pair of binoculars, says, "There's another small ship out there, but he's holding them very still. They're fairly large." He says, "That's a lifeboat. Looks smashed." He says, "I can read the word wall on the side of it." So they agree it's probably from Waller. It's probably a lifeboat, but it appears just to be the bow of the ship sticking up out of the ice and broken wood frozen into it.
Well, they didn't get very far.
No. So that is it. There's nothing more. The captain says, "Well, let's push on, everyone."
Wow, what a sad adventure. It's too bad all those people died.
Captain Stark, or Mr. Starkweather, comes aboard, asks for an update. You give it to him. Oh, interesting. Well, at least we got to see something from the real world here. And he says, "What's that you got there?"
"Whiskey."
"Oh, my word." "Well, you've got some salvaging." Pats me on the shoulder, and off he goes. He's still smiling at the moment about previously, about the Tallahassee being stuck in the ice.
Did somebody bring the coins?
I did.
Can I see some of those?
You don't know about them.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what I wanted to know. I assume that you guys have told me, but...
We're going to examine them. Right. We're going to examine the coins. I'll let them look at them.
Yeah, I'm only an archaeologist. That's okay.
They're coins. They have no words on them. There are no designations of country, of origin, no denomination. But they have strange sea creatures on them, things you've never seen.
None of these look like coins of a nation that we know of, right?
No.
Are they... Are they look like they've been struck, kind of a little lopsided, and the sea creature is an indentation. Yeah.
They don't look like they've been machined. They look like they've been struck.
Okay. Weird.
Wow. Hey, souvenir.
We'll talk
can, I make
to the
an, can I make an maybe. Occult roll and see if I recognize the creatures, if I've seen them before?
Yes.
I did not make it.
Then you do not recognize it.
There we go. Easy.
Easy peasy.
Asked and answered.
Are they real sea creatures, like things we would recognize, or are they like
mythological looking things?
Yeah.
Does anybody have any biology or mythology or
yeah, I've got tons
theology?
I have natural world.
I've got lots of ologies.
I have archaeology and I have occult.
I went to the zoo once.
I slept at a Holiday Inn.
No, I've got paleontology, paleobotany, biology.
I've got history.
So I would probably be able to recognize, and I got a 14, so I passed.
They have general shapes that look,
they look like sea creatures, but nothing I've ever seen.
But nothing you've ever seen. They don't look like, they look like they...
They
would eat people.
They
look like they
live under the sea.
They have all the right parts and shapes. They look like they would live in our waters. It's just nothing you've ever seen before.
Okay.
All right.
Like a fish looks like a fish. A drawing of a fish looks like a fish.
Right.
Put a tentacle on top of its head, doesn't look like the same fish.
That's really... Who would make these kind of coins?
How old do they look?
Yeah, it doesn't tarnish.
They could be 1,000 years old and still look just like new. What does the archaeologist say? Does he have any idea where these might be from?
I'll give it a roll.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. 12.
Well, you haven't seen these before. They don't match any known areas of the world you've ever done work or studied. They're totally foreign to you.
Wow. I was guessing Phoenician, but that was a guess based on...
You know where I bet there's an answer to this question?
Where is that?
The journal.
Well, we have to sit down and study the journal.
Absolutely. I mean,
we just glanced over it. I figured that we would learn a lot more of what was going on from reading the journal, but...
Agreed.
I figured I would do that tonight. You know, I mean, get back on the way of whatever.
We ain't doing anything. Let's go sit in the mess hall and read it. Read it to us.
I thought we all had to be on ice patrol.
Oh, that's right. We probably do.
Yeah, everybody's requested to have 8-hour shifts on ice patrol and general duties just because of the damage done to the ship so far.
Okay.
I would prefer not to become the Titanic, you know what I'm saying?
So, ice patrol, yep. General work. Just the day passes on, and the day your shifts end, I would assume you're all on pretty much the same shift, and that's the end of it.
Shift ends, we're going to sit down and read the book.
Yeah, let's go pour some coffee and pour over that thing, and let's see what it says.
Well, in truth, it's a very boring journal. I'll say you have it has the usual, this day the weather was like this, this day we did this, nothing initially revealing, and it appears that they went south with the intention of whaling. They encountered pack ice. They They were crushed. They were trapped in ice. The ice kept building up around the bottom of the ship. Eventually, there's a breach. There's a fire. There's an explosion at some point further on. And then one by one, the survivors died off as they ran out of food. A group of men were set out in a lifeboat to try to find their way through the pack ice out with some food, and that's the then you get to the last journal entries. There's nothing of note for this voyage, other than it went very badly.
That's really incongruent with what the very last journal entry read. And unless was there something else that I missed here? There was coins, there was a journal, because the very last one, you know, he mentions, you know, the blue veins or the red veins or something creeping up his arm.
Oh, that's septicemia. He's got tetanus. He's dying.
He's got
red marks moving up past his tourniquet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
There is talk of, he doesn't go into detail about everybody. He goes and talk about his injuries, about other people's injuries, but every injury is now a threat to their lives.
Right.
Infection setting in, lack of food, the cold. I just very heavily summarized it, but there is nothing within the journal that indicates where the coins came from.
So it's just a very professional journal that the captain.
What about the bag the coins came in? Is there anything of any mark on the bag?
Handmade leather bag, leather stitching, a drawstring. Like the Beagle Boys would steal.
My assumption here is like, you know, it's like a crooked accountant. There's the books that everyone sees, and then there's the real books. You know, then there's the journal that everyone sees, and then there might have been another journal.
Well, we explored the ship to everything that there was to explore, so we didn't find anything.
It's a mystery. Never be solved.
Ceslavi.
Maybe we'll find the answer to the coins down the road some. I mean, we'll stop at ports and stuff like this, and so you never know.
Maybe there's no more ports.
Now, but.
Well, then I have a nice keepsake souvenir.
Ask a nearby penguin.
Not as cool as a little ukulele, but I mean, what the hell.
Well, they're not doubloons, so they're probably just some coins from Tahiti or something, and we just don't recognize them.
Doubloons.
An arts and crafts project from one of the sailors.
Are they gold?
Well, you have to do that. No, they appear to be gold.
Well, then who cares what they originally were? It's gold.
I mean, they're soft. It's a soft
gold. Gold is gold.
That gold-colored gold, yes. Yeah. All right. Days move on. You're pushing south through the pack ice for 5 more days, leaving the whaler behind. Fog shrouds the surface of the ice constantly. Burns off briefly when the winds pick up and you get flurries of snow. Each day is the same. Endless grinding succession of thrusts against the icy walls, the lead. Sometimes progress made, sometimes not. Sometimes you get pushed back. Forward progress sometimes is measured in feet and yards, not hundreds of yards or 20 miles like the day before. On November 8th, the last lead closes over before and behind, and Gabriel's trapped in a narrow stretch of water, pulse sandwiched between frozen walls. Pack is utterly silent, save for the occasional crack or bang, sometimes distant rumbling through the ice. We have only two choices, Starkweather says to you guys and everybody else on deck. We either wait for a storm to free us, which could crush us as well, risky undertaking at best, or we blast our way free. He grins, smiles.
He grins, he smiles.
And he says, I favor the dynamite. Let's put it to a vote.
I vote for dynamite.
Dynamite.
Shocking, Elmer. Shocking.
Sparky yells out of the window above the radio tower, dynamite!
Is there any risk of the dynamite damaging the ship?
I was going to say, he's going to light the dynamite.
How far can you throw?
Well, I don't think that's what they're going to do. They're going to bury holes, yeah, you know, 100 feet off so that it cracks up the ice.
Oh, right. Okay.
Does anybody have experience with placement of dynamite or explosives?
Yes.
Nope, I'm sorry. Explosions were my other character.
I am a former Royal Engineer.
Dang. There
well,
you
he's
go.
He's going to pull you into this.
That's the ticket.
Packard, Sykes, and Griffith all have a small amount of experience with explosives. They certainly want to bring you onto the team.
I took a course in dynamite.
That's right. So you have some experience as well. Anybody took the explosives course?
I do.
So into light.
Mm-hmm. Count to 10 and throw.
That's right. Blasting teams lowered onto the ice, over the side onto the ice carefully. It's thick. It's not like you're going down on 3 inches of ice on a pond. The climbing the flows, you scout forward and aft. You're looking all over the place. You get to wear your winter gear. You're looking for weak spots in clear water. Finally, so the lead decides on the place to put the sticks. Charges are planted. Appropriate places in the flows and detonated with very long fuses. Could everybody who's going make a climb roll, please? Or dexterity roll twice.
Climb 47 out of 80.
Wow.
Great. Okay. Then you don't fall down. And could you make an explosives roll?
I failed that.
You failed it. Oh.
I didn't say it was good at.
Oh, hang on. I don't know whether I'll see what the other one is.
We have an explosives roll? Oh.
If there's a class in it, where were you?
I took the science classes.
Oh, yeah. Useful.
I'm a lover, not a fighter.
You were doing the ballroom dancing, weren't you?
The ballroom. Dancing. That's right.
He was at yoga class.
Uh-huh. Oh. Did you make it, Nick? Or Captain Sugden?
Yes, I did, yeah.
All right. Well, both of the fellows. Oh, actually, there's three. Two of the three plus Elmer failed. So at the first go, there's a big blast and smoke and ice and ice and bits of snow flying around. Nothing happens. Next time the ship goes vroom, pushes forward through the hole you've made in the ice. Three times pushing through, and the lead groans and opens with a roar and everyone cheers. So half dozen more times you have to go through it over the following 2 days. You don't have to role play those. And every time the old thick ice seems impassable, they call upon you and your team, and the ship eventually pushes its way through. November 10th, Sparky comes out yelling again. He goes, "Guess what, everybody? Lexington's camp has been established."
But
they got their base camp on... Oh, sir, go ahead.
I was just going to say, but they're a long way from the coast, aren't they?
They made it to the Ross Sea Barrier. Okay. So it's ahead. And as he gives you the news and he heads over to Starkweather's office, the last of the ice parts and the open water, the ice, you can see in the distance, there's open water.
Cool.
Through a path. Takes you a day to get there. Through thinner ice, and it's a ticklish path, his passage, the captain says, but he makes it through. Pack is loose, lots of heavy flowing ice slamming together without warning. Always threats to crush the hull because the ice is moving quickly here, but the captain manages to save the ship time and again, nudging icebergs aside, thrust aside the big bergs as possible, as only he can find it possible to do whatever. On the 12th, snow flurries once again close the world to within a few yards of the ship. Gingerly is pushing forward again, Lookouts on all sides. Everybody's called out to be lookouts in the ship and watch for flows of poles again in case they get close. And at one of the lookouts finally calls out, a sea, and all engines stop. And the rumble of motion ceases. Everyone aboard knows what's happened. The ship is rocked gently, the slow swell of the sea once more. And for all that night and the following day, the ship pushes on through the pack. And easily shoved aside, you're no longer in the pack ice. It's verified. And again, finally, the pack ice is gone. And on the 13th, at 10:20 in the morning, you've pushed into open water. Completely open water. And early on the 14th, 28 days after leaving Melbourne, land is sighted to the south. A few hours later, horizon's filled with the sight of the Admiralty Range, and everyone's on deck, and at last you reach Ross Island.
Yay!
And this was what date?
This is on the 14th of November.
And there was much rejoicing.
Oh, there is. There's dancing on the decks.
Hooray. I'm going to get me a penguin.
And
thank
the deck
God we learned the ballroom dancing.
That's
now.
Right. That's why you learned it. All right. Tuesday, the afternoon of the 14th, you approach Ross Island, and you draw cautiously into the icy waters around McMurdo Sound to the west. You can see Mount Erebus, which is a volcano, actively smoking. And the region of the Ross Sea is still solid with ice. I mean, there's still solid ice around the edge of the land. 6 to 8 feet above the surface of the water. And the barrier easily visible here rises up like a wall several miles distant across broken ground. Starkweather's excited. He says, "We've arrived. Captain, anchor the ship. We'll begin our assault from here. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Antarctica." Within an hour, ship is secured to the ice with long whirring lines, and the hatches are opened. What the heck? Sorry, I just went and read the wrong thing. No. The hatch.
And everything inside the hatch is gone.
No! Sorry. I skipped toward the wrong page. Everything's fine. So the hatches are opened and things are prepared for removal. People are starting to do jobs, and he says everybody's going to have jobs. So you have to decide what you wish to do. He's given you lots of indications. There's dog sled work, there's offloading tractors, there's aircraft, there's assembly of aircraft, all kinds of things to do.
Obviously, I'll be doing the aircraft.
I will be working on getting all the drilling equipment and setting up whatever we're going to set up in camp. Now, is there a permanent camp here, by the way?
Not at this time.
No. Okay. So I'll just help with whatever I can help with.
Okay. There's a landing plan put together by Starkweather and Moore. And the essentially men and women helping with the transfer are divided up into four work gangs. Three of these move cargo off the ship, the fourth prepares temporary camp on the thicker sea ice a few hundred yards inland. Dogs and sleds are the first to be transferred. So anybody who wishes to assist with that can do that.
I'm going to do that. I'll work with the dogs.
Cool. Pulaski and Fiskarsson set out across the ice in search of an easy ride up to the top of the barrier. So once the dogs are on board, that's what they're going to be doing. So they're looking for a pathway off the initial landing spot into the barrier area. The tractors are offloaded and assembled. Aircraft will be moved to the campsite as soon as the tractors are ready. So that's happening quite quickly. So I assume, Nigel, you're working on that.
Yeah.
So if they have to be put together, and you know what to do that with all that. So there's no.
Yep.
per cruise, all that. Does anybody have electrical repair, mechanical, other than Sparky?
I do.
Oh, you're working on the aircraft, though. Okay, well, let's just say Sparky and some of the other people are assisting. They're coming off the ship. They don't want to, but they are a bit, just for a while. It takes about 12 hours to unload the ship and a few more hours to establish a temporary camp. And all the time, you can see the smoke drifting off the volcano, something that some of you have never seen before in your lives. At 6 o'clock the morning of the 5th... Oh, sorry, go ahead. I thought you were saying something. At 6 o'clock morning of the 15th, the Gabrielle casts off from the ice and pushes free into the Ross Sea. And she will sit there idle for a few weeks. So everything's been offloaded. Temporary base camp is set. And it's there as needed, but generally you're not going to be going back and forth to the ship. You're on Antarctica permanently now. Well, not permanently, but for the duration of the expedition. Tents are assembled, hot meals prepared. The first aircraft has been put together finally. And the pieces, the other two, the first aircraft is called the Scott. And then there's the Weddell and the Enderby. They've been uncrated and they're getting ready for being assembled the next day. Most of the fuel is near the shore. It's going to take several days to ferry it inland to the camp, but enough is present for an initial flight by the Scott once the runway is finished. So, first evening, what is it? You've got your tents, you've got your food.
I imagine we're going to celebrate a little bit, aren't we, now that we're here?
I got some rye whiskey.
Excellent.
Everybody seems to be doing a little bit of celebrating, but there's people on watch everywhere because you are on what they call living ice. Some of them are referring to it as.
Right. If it cracks and starts to float, we better get off.
Can you explain the weather again? What are we?
It's cold.
It's cold, and it's hovering around 0 degrees Fahrenheit right now.
Is there, at where we are right now, is there any plant life?
Not where you are right now. You are on ice that is attached to the shore.
Okay. And how far off is the shore?
Well, let me see what I can show you. I don't know how big this will show up. This is not the best map. I'll try to get you a higher quality one. You know what? It's not even actually worth showing you. There's nothing shown in the map. The distance between where you are and the shore, it's really quite close, really. Like it's you can see the shore from the island. It's when there's actually a path like that could be made, a very straight section of ice between the shore and the island. Like it can be driven on the tractors within 15 minutes.
Hmm. McMurdo Station.
Not there yet.
But that's about where we are, though.
Generally, yes.
On that little peninsula, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. There's McMurdo Sound. Mount Erebus is on, you know, is there as well. Mount Terror is there as well. You can see those. Generally, it's you're near. Well, I guess it would be. So I can't tell you that because it's not the right time of the history there. Anyway, you've got your base camp set up. Everybody's having a few drinks and some quiet celebrations. Well, you're nervous because you do hear exhilarating at the same time as frightening. The wind rises, visibility drops to zero when it does, and with snow is blown around, you can't see anything, and whiteouts are very common, even just come and go within minutes. It's easily to miscalculate. You're constantly tripping over your own feet. So it's something that you have to be very cautious of.
Okay.
And there's very little time to play, but Mr. Starkweather says everyone take a little bit of time to do as you wish.
Cool.
You can see on the western side of the island from distance, there are some old expedition huts as well.
I pull out my violin and I play some music.
I write my name in the snow.
With your finger? Oh, that's not what you mean. All right, so everyone bunks down. Things are being moved around, things are being shifted, and the tractors are put together. A runway is under construction. You can see from a distance a cairn of stones near Scott's 1911 hut, the Scott of the Antarctic. And right beside it, there's a Miskatonic University flag stuck in a cairn, sticking out of a cairn. You don't know what's in it, of course. Work continues. There's lots of things happening. Trail party radios are late in the 15th. You hear that the party of with the dogs have found a navigable trail up onto the barrier and an excellent campsite not far. So they're making plans right now to examine the site during the first flight of the Scott that day. Cool. Less than an hour later, you get notice that Acacia Lexington's expedition has flown nonstop over the South Pole in their monoplane, the Bell, and returned safely to base camp. And Mr. Starkweather doesn't say anything. Doesn't look happy, doesn't look unhappy, just sort of walks away from the radio operator.
Are they still about 300 miles away from us?
Not now, no. Well, they've obviously set up a base camp, and they're ahead of you in that they set up a base camp and had a runway and been able to fly over the South Pole and back. Okay. They're close by, but not within sight.
Okay.
2:15 that afternoon, the Scott is ready to fly. Halpernan and Longfellow are trying to decide who's going to fly. And Nigel, do you wish to?
Yeah, I'll take it up.
Trump them.
Yeah, all right, I'll take it up.
It will be the second one. Longfellow will go up with you. So it's a 2-hour flight. You fly over the suggested base camp. You see the Lexington Expedition Camp is actually located right near there, not very far away. You guys fly over it, take a look, waggle your wings to say hi, whatever you do, and then you fly south and west to the barrier's surrounding hills before returning. Everything's flawless. You land your plane, you report back to Starkweather. He's ecstatic, and he's happy that you were able to spot the Lexington base camp. Runway's being extended so you can get the other aircraft out. And Mr. Starkweather stays quiet, however, for the rest of the day, insists everybody work quickly. Okay. So your shift is over. Anybody wish to do anything of interest?
So now is there plant life anywhere around?
You're still at the temporary base camp.
I see.
You could actually, you have some free time if you wanted to head to the shore.
Like a half hour's walk. However, you said that the whiteouts can happen almost instantaneously. So, yeah, I ain't going to do that. That would be too dangerous.
It's not recommended by people who've been here before.
I can wait.
Okay. Next couple days, it's aircraft noises left and right. Enderby takes the air in the morning of the 16th, followed shortly by the Weddell. The smaller Scott continues to make mapping flights along the Ross Sea shore and mountains of the barrier's western edge, and the two Boeings begin the methodical process of airlifting the expedition to their new home. 40 miles away is where your new base camp will be. It's expected to take 6 days because of the number of flights they have to make and the wait. Mr. Moore says, "We have to move the base." He just mumbles when somebody's standing by. He said within a month, this sea ice is going to break up and float away, and the shore will be bare. And we got to be on top of the barrier by then, because when we leave in 3 months' time, we have to load directly from the barrier itself, which is too dangerous to do right now.
Right.
So each of the Boeings makes 5 trips on the 16th and 6 on the day after. By the afternoon of the 17th, the expedition's base camp is well established. More than half the explorers, including 3 sled teams, are there. 2 tractors, half a dozen men remain on the sea ice. Where do you guys wish to end up? Like, do you wish to stay on the sea ice, or do you wish to head to the base camp?
Head to the base camp.
Oh, yes. I'm
base camp.
The nearer I get to the mountains, the better I feel.
All right, it's the morning. Okay, it's the morning of the 18th. It's you guys are next. You've asked to have your names moved up. You hear a huge noise, like this giant crunching noise. And at first you think it's something from the aircraft engines, or perhaps it's something from the sea. You're not entirely sure, but a great crack in the ice opens not very far from your camp. It moves inland, a deep rippling pop, 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 pop. 2 hours later, they can't move the aircraft quite yet. The aircraft, it's gone off. It hasn't, the other one hasn't returned yet. It seems like it's aimed right at the camp. Like it's coming right towards the camp.
This is the temporary camp, yes?
This is your temporary camp. It's breaking up early. The sea ice is breaking up early. The expedition is not quite prepared for this because, as Mr. Moore said, it was going to be a month away. So a radio message informs the aircraft and the barrier camp of the trouble, and all hands are roused. So you have to race against time, getting things, loading things, trying to get things on the aircraft, food supplies, gasoline, dragged inland by the tractors, just anything to get it away from the crack. Eventually, the Gabriel steams closer, but it can't really do anything because it's far off, far enough away that it wouldn't be the next morning. 3 more hours, it's clear things aren't going well. 2 tractors are attached to short trains of heavy pallets, are trying to head overland towards the barrier along the dog sled trail. Everyone's ordered to go with the tractors. I mean, they can't even land the planes now here. So you have to make a trip and then another trip. And after 6 p.m., the Fisher's halfway across the runway, so it's totally impossible to land. He aborts the flight, and they decide they're going to be it's just too dangerous. And essentially, you lose 140 drums of aviation fuel.
Oh.
Yeah.
Not good.
So it's the tractor party struggles all night through lowering temperatures, blowing snow. They arrive safe but exhausted, and the sea is roughening so that Gabriel can't even get closer. The next day is just snow, and Mr. Starkwood says, well, he radios back, we just have to do what we have to do. So another runway is being constructed. So in the meantime, you're on the shore, and you're at a it's not quite a base camp, but you're at the shore. So,
just to clarify, is Starkweather with us, or is he back on the ship?
He's at the base camp. He's at the actual real base camp, the barrier camp, they're calling it.
I'm just concerned with getting all of our stuff safely. And staying warm.
Well, you'll have some of the tents were hastily packed up. You're able to put some tents together. You are able to feed yourselves, and a new runway is being constructed on the shoreline. But you can actually see your plants now.
Yeah, boring. No, we should. Of course, look at the plants.
We should all keep close together to conserve body heat.
You were always saying that. You said that when we were in the middle of the tropics.
It's just a suggestion.
You all just right. Can't wait to take your clothes off, can you?
All right.
It's a medical necessity.
One of the crewmen comes
Nothing
up to
funny
you.
About it.
And he says, I'm particularly cold. No. Dr. Lindenbrook, one of the crewmen comes up to you and Dr. Hawk. And he says, I've got this weird feeling. This is just so many things going wrong. Everyone on the ship is just saying this is normal stuff, normal sea stuff. And he's a fairly new sailor. He's fairly green. He says, is this what, do these kind of things, this just seems like not just luck. This seems off.
What sort of things are you talking about?
Well, the sabotage was sabotage. And he looks around to make sure that none of the other crewmen can see him. He says, the sabotage, well, that was just some crazy guy. He said, but constant things. The crack in the ice, the ice isn't even supposed to be breaking up for a month. It's like something's got it in again. Something's against us. Something that has it in for us. Does that make any sense to you?
I wouldn't read too much into it. Everything is unpredictable in this kind of weather. So far we've done pretty well, I'd say.
Can I do a psychology roll with him just to, you know, maybe try to calm him?
Yeah.
Calm him down. Sure. A bit. Just said, you know what, when we started this expedition from the beginning, the thing is everything was against us. So I think we just have to take this day by day, be positive. That's, you know, that's the biggest thing.
We have persevered.
Yes.
Well, I see what you mean, but I'm not used to this. It's just, everything just seems against us.
Well, I'll say your prayers.
Yep. Well, he wanders off.
I think this has a learning experience. So.
He mutters to himself. He's just, he goes off and he talks to some other crewmen, like maybe he's trying out them too, and they sort of, guy, get out of here. Everything's fine. Kind of.
He's cursed.
Yeah, that's what he's implying, is that there's some kind of a curse. They were talking about the Stark weather earlier, and it seems to be poking up again in the discussion.
Is he wearing a red shirt?
Well,
a mask and cap.
Red hats down here. Yeah. So the next day, you have your landing strip, and bit by bit, things are landed, and people are shipped off to the new base camp.
Okay.
So you arrive at the base camp. It is not luxurious. Quarters are cramped. The two wooden huts are barely large enough for everyone to stand in all together. And most of the explorers are in tents, in depression, sheltered kind of from the wind as best they could do with walls built up out of blocks of ice and snow. Dog kennels are still being constructed. The weather shack is being constructed. Laboratories and dark room are all being constructed. So there's lots of work for everyone to do. Hangars for the airplanes are far from complete. Nigel, you're not too happy to see that. The two functioning Boeings, the Wedding and Enderbury and Little Scott, are firmly tied down and well anchored. But you and the pilots are constantly looking at them because you don't like the idea they're being left out in the open like that. To make sure they're not damaged by wind and things flying around.
Right.
Dogmen and guides work. Work with the sleds and teams, uncovering, exploring trails, setting flags ever farther from the camp, and the aerial wires for radio are strung. The Bodhi drills are now assembled and tested, ready for time. The plan is for Lasky, Fiskerson, and Snabjorn to depart the next morning with three sleds on a cache-laying journey. Their plan, what they do is they go out, they lay emergency supplies 250 miles away along the flight path to Lake's Camp in the Miskatonic Mountains. Sleds are prepared. Everybody's sleeping. There's lots to do. But on November 20th at 3 a.m., you hear a bell ringing. And This clouds are, you know, it's cloudy and the air is still, the sun shining brightly from the southeast. It's 3 a.m. and the sun's still up. But the bell's not loud. A few of you hear it and you rouse the others. Eventually, people are awakening and yelling at others. But it's just, what is that bell? What is that bell? It explained, everyone says that's the actual radio's Mayday alarm. Somewhere, someone else is calling for help. It's like a bell being rung through the radio Starkweather jumps out of the tent and jogs across the ice to the meeting hall without closing up his coat. Does anybody want to do a listen roll?
Sure.
Yep.
Sure.
I made it.
Passed.
Okay.
96. No.
There's a crowd around that is there before you, but those who pass, you're able to hear da-da, 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 and LaRoche tunes away and a voice can be heard. Help, if you can hear me, help, land a party at once. The camp is under attack. It's Tony Helpwell calling Tallahassee. Matt, can you hear me? There, and the voice stops. And there's two gunshots, bang, bang. Sounds like gunshots over the radio. And a moment later, the carrier wave fades, and all you hear is static. And LaRoche and Starkweather stare at each other at the radio, shock written on their faces. No one knows what to do. And 40 seconds later, a faint, hollow rumble like thunder rolls across the camp from the north.
Holy crap. Did they just explode?
Starkweather jumps, grabs a pair of binoculars from pegged by the door, exits the hut, pushing through all of you, and runs to high ground. So, any of you wish to do that, you can. He climbs a nearby ridge and scans the ice to the north, and there's nothing to be seen. It's too hazy. But the rest
isn't cold. What? There's nothing indigenous down here that's really a...
Yeah.
Threat. Do we think that this was the Lexington calling the Tallahassee? I heard the Tallahassee, but it sounded like someone was the radio operator from wherever it was coming or was calling for the radio operator of the Tallahassee. Is that correct?
Lexington, well, the radio man, is the woman.
The radio man hears you, and he says, that was Hopewell. He's the radio man for the Lexington. That's he said only what you heard. And that's all I know. And then he says, just give me a minute. He gets back in the radio, doing his stuff. And there's a conversation back and forth. And he says, oh, my God. He says, the Acacia's fuel cache and mess hall are totally ablaze, along with several tents. No one can see much from aboard the ship. The haze and the smog smoke. There's gunshots, and everyone can see a pall of smoke over the scene.
Look, they've got to have a runway already established. Why don't we fly in there and see what's going on?
Good call.
With the weather.
Well, Mr. Stark, yeah.
With the weather allowed.
Mr. Starkweather runs back in. He hears you talking, and he says, give me the microphone. He leans over the radio. Tallahassee, this is Starkweather. I'm preparing an overland party. It's only 8 miles. We ought to be there shortly. I'm taking food, fuel, and medical supplies. We cannot afford to bring a radio. So fire off two white flares when we arrive. Do you understand? Tell your captain not to worry. We'll do everything we can. And he hands the microphone back to LaRoche, and he flashes a delighted grin at all of you. And he says, come on, you lot. I want you, and you, pointing to all of you investigators and a few others that have first aid training. He says, we've got a young lady to rescue. And that's where we'll leave it for tonight.
Perfect.
Excellent. Okay, so our players included Jerry Bryant, Greg Malcolm, Bill Mize, Mick Swan, Jeff Wilkins, and myself with Sean Little as the Keeper of the Secrets. Our musical intro, Sleight of Hand, was composed by James Brett and is used with his permission. We're currently producing 4 shows a week with music and sound effects added in post-production in order to create a richer listener experience. We provide audio-only versions of our shows free for you to download from Podbean or iTunes. If you'd like to help us continue our show, please visit our Patreon account. Just $1 or $2 a month will help us a lot. Like, share, and subscribe our channel for updates on our latest shows, and leave us some comments. We love hearing from you. You'll find links to everything I mentioned in the description below. This is Tom Rayleigh, together with all the members of our gaming group, inviting you to journey with us once again into the darkness for another adventure into the universe of H.P. Lovecraft and the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. Until next time, good luck and good gaming.